Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Writers at Warwick. Before I start, could I just remind everyone to turn their mobile phones off, please? Thank you. Tonight, it is my great pleasure to welcome and introduce to you Toby Litt. Toby is the author of 5 novels and 2 collections of short stories. Last year, he was dubbed one of Granta's best young novelists, an accolade he shares with Zadie Smith, Susan Elderkin, Monica Ali, Harry Kunzru, Sarah Waters, and in the past has been given to people such as Martin Amis, Kazuo Ishiguro, and Jeanette Winterson. Tonight, Toby will be reading from his new novel, Ghost Story, after which there'll be a short discussion and questions from the floor. So please join me in welcoming one of the foremost young lions of British hip lit, Toby Litt.
Good. I always feel I should roar when I'm introduced with the young lions thing. That's Maxim Jakubowski, who runs the crime bookshop in London. He called me that. It seems to be following me around. I'm sort of booming slightly. If I could stop booming, that would be good. I'm going to read 2 sections from Ghost Story. One is from a fictional part of the book, which is chapter 12, but it's fairly self-contained. And then I'm going to read something from the opening section, which is autobiographical, and that also is fairly self-contained. And then you can ask me questions. Ghost Story, like the title suggests, is quite generic in that it is about a woman alone in a house at night quite often. And the reason that she is alone is that she's starting to live at different hours from her husband, Paddy, but also that her child is staying with their mother, her surviving child called Max, because her second child was stillborn a few months before this action takes place. And she and Paddy have moved to an unnamed seaside town somewhere in the south of England. And because Paddy is going to work today, every day, he's out of the house. Agatha is alone. And in fact, she hasn't left the house since they stepped over the threshold to move in. And the book is about, in one way, is what happens after the worst thing has already happened. Agatha continued to get up later and later every morning until after a while she was getting up in the afternoon. At first she tried to go to bed the same time as Paddy, but there was no chance of her falling asleep such a short time after she'd woken up. She began to wait until he started to breathe sleep breaths, then took herself downstairs for another hour or 2, 3, or 4. She found she loved the night house even more than she loved the day house, despite the fright of the darkness. She left her glasses off, and everything appeared to her through a vague mist. She much preferred it that way. The hours of light were becoming too explicit for her, too hardcore in the rawness of what they exposed. She wanted a veil between herself and the seen world. Daylight wasn't poignant enough to assist in the wanted pathos of her vision. Things she had hoped by now would have become scrubbed or invisible weren't. She needed all the human cavities, including her own, to remain enticing shadows, not red gleaming orifices of failed defense. One night towards the end of the first week, she turned off all the electric lights and lit a candle instead. She felt Victorian in the pallid flicker of it, participant in a less light-loving age. Candlelight, she found, calmed her raging insides, head and otherwhere, was what they used to call bromide. At 15, once or twice, she had read by candlelight, having realized that was what the first naughty or merely nightly readers of these books must have done. Now she tried to resurrect this as if it had been a whole important long period of her life. It hadn't, but also it had. An hour, the right hour, was an epoch, not just in youth, at any age of life. She was chasing or beckoning her own new epoch. It was important that she survive this one. In the flat, she had done this in one way, by over-caring for Max and preparing for their move to the night house. In the house, devoid of Max, she had to adapt. Night helped her to think. It was during one of the nights early in this week that Agatha first noticed something unusual about the sound of the waves. She had been trying to go to sleep at the same time as Paddy. When she had been trying to go to sleep at the same time as Paddy, Agatha had often used to lull herself by listening to the very quiet and very distant whoosh of the soft waves on the pebbly beach. She longed, part of her longed, to go down to the sea itself, but she remembered that even when she had been at its edge in times before, had sat for an hour and stared out across it, or dipped her hand in up to the wrist, or in summer swam out beyond the breakers, she was a strong swimmer. Even then she had not felt intimate enough with the differing element. There was always a preventative quality about the sea. Her first sight of it forestalled any real understanding, which had originally been one of her reasons for being very keen to live within an intimate distance of it. Her childhood had been, for the most part, landlocked, but she remembered her 8 or 10 weeks at the seaside in Devon and Cornwall over the course of several summer holidays as more lingering than the interior rest. Her seawards impulse was one of the most powerful she could recently remember herself having, apart from perhaps her griefwards one. In her mind, the two began to assimilate one another, and she became afraid that a visit to the sea would inevitably, like a visit to a patient in a mental hospital, be a courting of glamorous distress at some level. As she listened now, seated on the sofa, the two rhythms ran over and across each other, her breathing and the hushing of the waves. At times the two synchronized, she allowed them to synchronize, keeping her breath regular, but at a different, slightly slower pulse than the sea. In this way, like two clocks with minutely different tick-tocks, there was an eventual coming into sync, at which point Agatha matched her breathing exactly to that of the sea. It was a great relief and comfort, one of her most basic decisions being made for her, how to breathe and when. She had, ever since her first pregnancy, been very aware of the difficulties of breathing when it becomes self-conscious. And now she was self-conscious about almost everything, almost all the time. One day, not far off, she felt convinced she would no longer be able to undress in front of herself. Already she hid herself when she could from Paddy. There was a definite danger that she would soon be taking every aspect of herself far too seriously, in a childlike way, believing that decisions she made about whether or not to breathe now, were world changers. She was particularly worried that she might find a way of becoming superstitious about her breathing patterns. Her remembered child self on the car journey, promising herself a present from her parents if only she could hold her breath until the next but one bridge across the motorway. She was capable of it, superstition, and she feared these capacities. They seemed to operate for their own delight these days. Enamored of havoc and with an almost homicidal curiosity, the smallest change, like the change which had already begun between her and Paddy, was enough to reduce her to her alone, Paddy gone, taking Max with him. Nothing comforted her but things which ran parallel. The sea breathing, this she was able to bring to the point of ignorance, stripes lined up over stripes, when moved causing backwards ripples, like two fences seen one in front of the other whilst riding on a train. This night, she wasn't satisfied with the volume of the waves. She kept missing her rhythm. Perhaps the sea was too calm. She should check by a proper listen. The obvious place was out of the attic window, but Paddy's unspoken attitude to this was clear to her, as clear as if he had been whispering it into her ear, "Be brave." And perhaps she felt she could and should be. Night might make it easier. She went to the front door and began slowly to open it, an act which in itself did not yet terrify her, as she knew the act was in no way promissory. Paddy asleep, definitely asleep, she had quickly checked, would never know of it. Her achievement, opening the door, would give him no increased hope, and her failure to follow it by a step into the street would cause him no dismay. As she opened the door, its heaviness and greater legality compared to the doors within the house struck her. The outside that she was becoming afraid of was not one of actual man-made or man-incarnated threat. What she feared was not the specific but the vague, not what it might do to her, but the totality of the almost infinite vicious possibilities it contained. The air in front of her did not contain the simple blade of a knife. It was entirely blade, and entirely in every direction, and encountered with every movement, edge. A single step forward, she felt, and she would be cut to steak tartare, a smear of grey and red, meat mist. Agatha stood and looked out into the knife air, the edge air, feeling the impossibility of it. It wasn't a medium, it was a billion, billion tragedies. But as she got close to it, but she got as close to it as she could without getting cut. A young man walked past, head down, not seeing her, and it was like watching a shark in an aquarium or a tiger in slow motion. How did he not die? How did he make this his element? Agatha closed her eyes when she was sure he, still unharmed, was gone. She concentrated on the sea and was amazed to hear that since the first time she listened to it, a few moments before at the top of the stairs, after checking on Paddy, its pulse seemed to have slowed down. It sounded different, of course. She'd expected that. Louder, larger, paler, deeper. That's what she'd expected. But the pulse, she counted the seconds in between the waves, making it 5. Inside, she heard every wave, she believed, not just every loud one or every 7th. A deep breath, and now she concentrated instead on what she could smell. Strongest was not the sea itself, but the bittersweet of the seaside town, burnt sugar and bitumen. She could easily have told, blindfold, driven there by terrorists, that there was dense human occupation around her. Toxins were upon many levels of the air. At this hour, she smelled no specific smells, no cooking, not even a car gone by with a broken exhaust. Agatha heard a seagull nearby make its plaint. She couldn't tell whether or not it was overhead. There was something unnerving now about the sound of the waves. Inside, she had to listen, but not very carefully in order to hear them. Here, they seemed hardly audible at all. How was that possible? The house wasn't capable of focusing the sound, making it louder, the soft crash, the crumple of wet, momentary cliffs. She listened and was disconcerted by the illusion that the sound was coming from behind her, from inside the house. She suddenly became aware of her pajamas, blue and white vertical stripes, old, soft, many times worn cotton. Embarrassed, though no one was there, the young man gone, she needed to concentrate properly on the sounds. She could hear cars, knew them to be together with lorries, those on the main road, the one that ran along the seafront. The yawl and cark of seagulls was punctuation to this, as their shit was punctuation to the slate roofs and concrete pavements. They were a fact to be accommodated somehow. It wasn't good to admit even to oneself that one would prefer them not to be there, despite this being the seaside and them being a requirement. Acknowledging their presence didn't make them any less aggressive. They'd been known to steal food out of people's mouths, and in some ways it made the whole town seem more hostile. Not liking that thought, or its suggestion of an even longer self-containment, Agatha took a step back and closed the door. It was a couple of minutes before her breathing had slowed and calmed enough for her to listen again to what sea sounds made it into the house. She heard them differently now. They seemed more human, more raggedy. That was what she thought initially. This time, she didn't want to listen to them long, just hear they were still there. But it wasn't possible for her to ignore the fact that the waves were louder in the house than outside. She walked to the back of the hall and listened. They didn't seem quieter the further away from the door she got. To test again, she took herself into the back bedroom. They were the same. And again she found the same in the attic. Here she opened the window in the roof, for only the second time since they had viewed the house. This, surely, should be the best and loudest place for hearing the sea. But it was quieter. Perhaps, she now worried, it wasn't even the sea she heard outside, just cars going by on the London road. It was also, as she heard it, slower in pulse. Bringing herself inside, closing the double glazing, the waves were audible. But Agatha knew they couldn't be what she heard them as being. Scientific and decided, she tiptoed downstairs and into the main bedroom. Here, she listened to Paddy's breathing. It wasn't the same as in the attic or the hall, slower still and more rasping. Her heart was knocking her around, putting shaking blood in her hands. She went into the nursery, and a memory engulfed her. Standing over Max's cot in the weeks and months after he'd been born, each of Max's breaths had had the emotional impact of a small loaf of bread being baked. The weighing, kneading, covering, leaving, returning, repeating, greasing, ovening, smelling. To lean over his cot as he slept, small and growing, was, for Agatha, richly to be fed. There had been no opposite to this. It was everything. She had hated herself for the essentialism of it, but there, that baking, was a hook on which she'd happily hang the coat of her soul, a moment of permanence. She had been greedy, she knew, asking for another little bakery baby. After all, she only had one soul to hang. As long as it did not slip off, let it go dusty where it was for as long as it lasted there. The bread thought left her when she stepped out into the upstairs hall, making a deliberate break of the doorway. But it had left a suspicion with her that the regular whooshing, swooshing sound that she could hear wasn't the sea or her breathing or Paddy's, but was coming from the house, was the house's breathing. She didn't believe this, and nor did she want to believe herself capable of believing it. Madness was, right now, something best not thought about. If the house could breathe, what if it started talking? Her blood flipped from head to toe and she shivered in response. Only very rarely during her nights had she put music on. Now she needed some. It wouldn't matter if it woke Paddy up. That might force her to tell him what was happening. The stereo was in the front room and Paddy's old LPs were on a single shelf above it. She chose Billie Holiday, a singer whom she felt sang what she, Agatha, was like. She wasn't unaware that this, too, was how millions of other women and men felt. At this moment, I Cover the Waterfront was Agatha's life song, and she listened to it closely four times, ear up against the speaker cabinet. This, she was sure, wasn't the recording she had first heard. That had been on a very cheap tape bought in a charity shop, subsequently lent and never returned. That version had been frailer, even more moving in its loneliness and mistily hopeful despair than this one. Agatha knew herself to be in danger of sentimentality, didn't mind. What did she have in common with a long-dead, black, American, drug addict, ex-prostitute, genius jazz singer? Except everything ever. Surely, she thought, that's what Billy would have wanted. In the recording, she could hear the desire to communicate, and possibly, too, the knowledge that this communication could be disembodied. The ghost of Billy, coming out of radios while she herself was on a tour coach with the boys, or on an airplane, or in Europe, or dead. Agatha decided, best as she could, she would forget the breathing. It wasn't the fast breathing of a baby, that she at least was sure of. It wasn't, she hoped, the coming to life of a madness. When Billie Holiday stopped singing, Agatha remembered the moment she had left Max with her mother. Through the just-closed front door, before she had even had time to turn away, hands still in the air from waving, Max's small voice, "Where, Mummy?" She had stopped to listen. Her mother, in the hallway, had said to Max, "She's gone to get your new home lovely and ready for you." And Max had said, "Where, Mummy?" 3 times before starting to cry. The music was beautiful. Could I have the lights up now? Thank you. Thank you. Now I can see you. This section is autobiographical, in the about 2 years ago, my girlfriend had 3 miscarriages, which came quite hard, one on the other. And the section I'm going to read comes from when she was pregnant for the 3rd time, before that pregnancy ended. And it's called Our Father. As I was walking back from the tube station, I allowed myself for the first time to think, I'm going to be a father. It was an experimental thought, like trying on a pair of silly sunglasses when one has a longer than expected wait at the airport. Just as then, one would have no intention of buying the glasses and having to accommodate one's self-image to their silliness, so now I had no feeling of permanent personal investment in this sentence. I let it appear in my mind. I gave it a second in which to flash like a neon sign. I wanted to watch the afterimage gently fade, but I'd chosen the wrong moment. I was halfway across the small side road that runs alongside the station, and although it would be making melodrama to write, I staggered. I certainly felt a lurch inside of me, as if I were a small car and a suitcase full of gold bars, I was going to say bricks, had just been hefted into my boot. No one, looking on, would have noticed anything in my walk more unusual than a slight extra give at the knees, the thighs and hips dropping an inch or two lower than one might have expected. The weather the previous day, at almost exactly the same time, would have been more fitting for this burdensome moment. There'd been an April shower. The sky looked orange, electric, as if shot through a filter for an apocalyptic car advertisement. The sun was low enough to shine out from beneath the cloud canopy, which was thick towards the west but thinned out towards to nothing and blueness towards the east, where Canary Wharf stood as a wedge of silver, looking its absolute optimistic best. As I walked towards home, stopping briefly just past the chip shop to put my umbrella, my girlfriend Lee's, borrowed, up, I had a thought. I had thought, there will be a rainbow here somewhere. But it was only when I reached the 4th floor walkway outside our flat that I spotted it, to the right of Canary Wharf, which already looked duller, pewtery. Lee was on the sofa reading, and I called her to come out and look at the left foot of the rainbow, which was all that could be seen of it before it disappeared behind the side of our building. I told her how I had predicted it, and I felt glad to be ratified by her believing me. On this, the following day, when I thought, I'm going to be a father, the weather moment was quite different, with sun go downy in a nondescript no-season way. As soon as I was over the side road, more words came into my head, and over these ones I had far less control. They were not a neon sign. They were stray reflections of an already emitted light. I thought, Our Father who art, which was shocking enough in itself, but very quickly, in parallel almost, I had 2 further thoughts. One was, I'm thinking that I'm God. Although this had been by a few instants preceded by, I'm going to be God, which I suppressed by conversion even before I'd voiced it. The next thought was that Our Father might make a good title for something, for a story or a book. But this thought, too, had its almost instant dismissal. Andrew O'Hagan had already, I knew, written a book called Our Fathers. It was a great title. It was his. Good luck to him, bastard. I forgot this very quickly in the turbulence of my reaction to the God sentence. The second version of it was disturbing enough, but something of the first still echoed around. I thought, did I really think that? Or some self-dismissive, self-comforting version of that sentence. At the same time, I was aware that I'd walked past the off-license. Earlier in the day, during a phone conversation, Lee had suggested that for dinner we have a curry delivered. My first instinct, drink-wise, was wine, red wine, but beer came in heavily an instant later. Beer with curry, cold and gingery with throat burn, and the anticipated sensation of quite how fantastic and proper that would be. Concentrating on this, going into the shop, saying hello to whomever was behind the counter, this too would give me some means by which to suppress the internal fact that, a few steps back, I had thought that becoming a father would make me become God. As I pushed open the off-license door, a few dregs of this thought trickled away. They were disturbed recapitulations, intended to make it easier for me to believe my own accustomed version of myself. I meant God for someone. I didn't mean God. I meant that position of power. Behind the counter in the off-license was a young black woman whom I dealt with once before. My wonderings about how she found working there, racism in the area being fairly bad, and the off-license having been subject to armed robbery a couple of weeks earlier, my wonderings effaced the God sentence pretty well completely. I took the 6 cans of cold beer home to find Lee sitting on the sofa reading. I bought you some beer, she said. I should add something about the knee dip in my walk as I had the God thought crossing the road. That is how my father walks, though I only realized this, in fact, in writing this. My father's walk is magnificently ornate. It comprises so many separate micro-movements into the simple accomplishment of forwards going. Up, down, left, right, strange, charmed, lifting, swaying, swinging, lurching. I can't possibly sort out the order in which these differences synthesize. I think my father is aware of the magnificence of his walk. I think this because sometimes, when we were children, he used to parody it for us, pretending to reel, drunk, or to be about to collapse under our huge weight whilst giving one of us a shoulder ride. It sounds ungenerous, but when you see my father walking away from you, he looks like an elephant doing a John Wayne impersonation. He looks, I'd say, like God must look, walking away from you. Thank you.
Toby, I know that the book hasn't quite hit the shelves everywhere yet, but without giving too much away, I wanted to kick off with something about the kind of the redemptive nature of what you're trying to do. In a way, the ghosts, the breathing, the scraping, it ties back to something that seems to involve an act of catharsis in the writing.
Catharsis or redemption?
Catharsis.
Christian or Greek?
Perhaps. Yeah, but then I'm thinking also Lee's role in this.
Yes.
She's a character, but it seems to be, it seems as if the book is for her.
Yes, it's dedicated to her. Mm. I wrote it in her direction, if you want to put it like that. I was aware that it was her book in the sense that She was the reader whose opinion counted for more than anyone else's possibly could. And so, of course, she was the first reader and the best reader, I'm sorry. But she also she's someone who's a professional reader. She teaches English at University of Westminster and actually did her degree in English here. She's in no way a naive reader. And one of the things that happened when we first got together, she read Corpsing, and she's very theoretically sophisticated. So the idea that, not quite the death of the author, but that you don't autobiographically read everything was something she was quite used to. But she'd be reading the story sitting alongside me, and she was finding it very difficult not to read me into it and think, what's this new boyfriend like? Has he got all these thoughts in his head? She
add for the audience that the narrator is rather
a git.
Especially towards women, I think you might say.
Yeah.
So yeah.
He's got problems because he's been shot, and he's trying to build himself back up as a man. And unfortunately, misogyny is one of the things he seems to choose. Mm. To go back to the question, or the implied question maybe, Lee was pleased that I'd written the book and pleased that I'd written it in the way that I had. There were some changes she asked for, which I made, which were mainly to do with the fact that her parents might read it. They were quite small. She was glad at least that something had come out of what was otherwise a sort of useless experience, one that just created grief rather than anything that you would really want to say you'd learned from.
Okay. There's something you said there about the best reader. I think Virginia Woolf or someone said about wanting the best reader to create the best writing out of you. And I mean, it's very different to Corpsing or any of your other novels. Although there is that aspect of a kind of postmodern device that makes you slightly self-conscious of what's
you
going on.
You said the postmodern word.
I'm sorry, but it's been there.
I thought I'd left it behind me in London.
There's something about the self-consciousness of changing the reader's perception of what's going on. You know, you're putting in non-fiction at the start and a lengthy preface with a couple of short stories. I think Hare was in the Granter?
It was in the Granter book, yeah.
That's right. And then this ghost story that's very different. But throughout, there's this kind of changing of perceptions. And getting the best writing out of yourself, the transition from previous novels and the style there. What were you reading when you wrote Ghost Story? It seems like Henry James and perhaps German philosophy.
Were you hiding in my study? some of both of those things. The main character, the main male character, Paddy, is a philosopher. Mm-hmm. His subject of interest is skepticism, and his theoretical nut to crack is proving the existence of other minds, which is very much a live debate, and it's one which contemporary British philosophers do work on. And that's basically sort of half a paragraph about him, that information, but I was interested in reading some of that philosophy about how you can prove that other people aren't ghosts in the sense, or how you can believe in them in a sense that you don't believe in ghosts. How can they be any more definite? Even if you live with them, sleep with them, whatever, smell them. How can they be more definite than ghosts, philosophically?
Okay. So coming back to the transition, the change, Was it purely a matter of what you were reading? Or was there a conscious choice to change style, to adapt?
Well, each book has changed from the previous. I think the gap between Dead Kid Songs as a novel and Finding Myself as a novel is at least as big. And there is really a boredom that I have with something I've already done. It is the T.S. Eliot quote about you know, having the tools only for the problem that you've solved, that you work a style up to deal with what it needs to in a particular story or novel, and then if you were just to try and put that into another story, it just would be a dead thing. It wouldn't. That's not the way to write, as far as I'm concerned. They have specific needs, each story, and I was really very concerned with making it an emotional book, and making it a book that tried to take the characters' thought processes really in the detail and the depth that I feel is lacking in a lot of writing, which is cinema in black and white on the page, which doesn't dare go inside people's heads, basically because it seems that Freud has colonized the inside of people's heads and cinema actors and actresses have colonized their exterior. So there seems very little you can do in the way of going into people. And so James is a model for that, in that he's probably the most fine sort of instrument of measuring the nuances of human thought that there's ever been. I think you could put Proust in the ring with him, but really that was a conscious model.
Okay.
But he's also my favourite writer. So.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll stop there. I'm going to stop hogging the discussion, pass out. Are there any questions in the floor? We have the lights up a little bit, please. The one there.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes.
Hello.
Sure, if I heard that right, was that how do you consider yourself as a contemporary British novelist? And
yeah,
so how do you compare yourself to other contemporary novelists, perhaps?
Qualitatively or quantitatively? I think that if you read the Granter anthology, which has 20 writers in, if you see what they are doing, and you read the story which starts Ghost Story, and which is the first ghost story called The Hare, I think you'll see that it's a different thing in terms of fantasy, in a sense that. I'm writing about the supernatural sometimes, or I'm writing about in a more excessive way, I think. There are some of the stories in Exhibitionism where I tried to write as vulgarly as possible. And I think that there are areas of writing which I think are unpopulated at the moment because they don't fit with the 20th century's sort of culminatory ideas of what good writing is, which would be clean, clear, very visual, very fast, influenced by cinema and terrified by psychoanalysis, into something that describes the outside of people and tries to find an appropriate gesture to convey to you the emotion that they're feeling inside. And I attack this in different ways. In Ghost Story, I've tried to write what goes on inside people. In other stories, I've written fantasies of that are unreal in that sense, just because I think that realism isn't reality. I don't believe that those sentences that the writers write, the sort of clean American creative writing course sentences, tell anything like the truth about the subjectivity of any simple action, of walking into a room. If you say he turned the key in the lock, walked into the room and turned the light on, that's a very clinical description of some physical actions that tell you that. But that room in the dark is just as likely to be a deep dark forest or bottom of the sea or populated with monsters or nightmares or any kind of phantasmagoric things as it is just to be a room. I don't really think that objects and the way the world works is that simple, that rationalistic. So I think that I'm perhaps looking to older models, maybe than some of the other people around. But I, in one word, I feel isolated, but in a good way.
Sorry, it's one there.
Sure.
Repeat the question. It's just the question was whether or not when Toby Lipp prescribed an idea of writing from hatred, or was it self-abnegation, would you prescribe this for other writers, male and female? Would it be relevant?
And also that it's probably less helpful for female writers. That was an essay I wrote in Poetry magazine called Writing, and I really was trying to do something as broad as, say, what I thought writing was. And the hate isn't a word that gets used to in many circumstances, but not in relation to writing. But I think it has a part. It's a very powerful force, and it can be the thing that's behind revenge or a decision to sort of tell your truth. It can be a hate of untruths that you see elsewhere. But what I was really talking about was an aesthetic self-hate, which means that when you write something, you're not precious about it. You're prepared to slash it to bits to make it better, to erase all the crap out of it, and so you become better. So this is how I think writers become better, by hating the badness in themselves, the aesthetically rubbish things, and getting rid of them. And as they do that more and more, less of it comes out. You hope less of it comes out. I didn't gender the writer when I wrote that piece. I wasn't really thinking in any terms, but what you're saying is perhaps true in the sense that many women writers or women who want to write feel at the very start that they have no dispensation to do that, that they have a barrier between them and writing which is permission, and that they can't give themselves that permission. And male writers seem to have much less of a problem thinking that they're worth listening to, basically, just like men in a pub or at the end of an evening when they start talking about films and bollocks like that. And it's true that at that point self-hate would be a block, really, and it could cause someone not to become a writer. But at the same time, I think that the process of becoming a writer worth reading would still depend on destroying the bits in your writing that make it bad, because most people start as bad writers, I would say. I think it's necessary. I think it's even necessary for myself to write badly to begin with, in order to allow myself the things that come out in that, rather than writing demurely. And I think the real problem for female writers at all stages is demureness. And so if you can't allow yourself to believe yourself capable of hate, then you're going to be a very neutered writer. And that goes back to the famous Austen about the famous essay about Jane Austen and regulated hatred. And when I can't remember who it was, a critic, said that Jane Austen is all about hate, I mean, basically the whole English literary establishment was in a tiz. But it's true. It is true. She is lacerating. But I'm sure she was more than anything else lacerating on herself as a writer. I think she cut the crap in her head rather than on the page. Yeah.
How would you have felt about if you'd said, this is just me, or was there a part of you that wanted to publish anyway?
The question was, how would Toby have felt if his partner Lee had stepped in and said she didn't want him to publish the new novel?
Yes. What would I have done? I think I'd have been quite devastated because I wrote it sort of sincerely as I could to, as I said, to try and make something out of experience that otherwise seemed a waste of life in all the senses, that there were potential lives that didn't come into being, but also in period, years of our lives. And so I think I'd have basically questioned whether I knew who she was, really, because I felt that the book was almost, and this isn't really sort of in the public domain, but almost a tribute to what she does, which is that her main interest in academia at the moment has been at the Society for Psychical Research and looking into 19th century theories of survival into different dimensions, and she did her PhD on a writer called May Sinclair, who's very famous, or who's most famous for writing ghost stories. So I was trying to do a new ghost story, I think at that point it wouldn't have just been the novel that would have gone splat. I think our relationship would have been difficult because I would have misread her, I think, and I really wanted it to be, her favourite thing that I'd written, even though it's obviously not a neutral book, it's a very emotionally charged book, but it was really as much of a gift as I could make it. So I guess it would be the same thing if you spent over a year making the best gift you could for someone and they said they didn't like it. That's how I'd have felt.
Take one more question, perhaps. I can't really see it. One up there.
Hello.
Hi.
You read the fiction to us in the dark.
Yes.
And the autobiography.
So just say that was about the lights up and the lights down. How does the reader approach the two parts of Ghost Story?
Well, obviously, I read them the other way round, and it is a book that gets darker. Yeah, it's definitely a book that goes into the dark of the house, and the space gets smaller and smaller. There are fewer and fewer characters, there is a sense in which the space that the first part takes place in is too well lit. I don't want to pun on my own name, but it's a medical space. You go into hospital. It's about things coming to light which shouldn't. They need to spend 9 months in the dark before they come out. And so you're right in that, I think, in that it is about a break of that sort. But at the same time, it's partly called Ghost Story because I want the two parts to haunt each other, sort of. I want people to read the autobiographical section, directly autobiographical section, in the context of the Hare, which is the story at the start, and Foxes, which is at the end, which are quite strange and obtrusive in a way. They make it less smooth as a transition. And then I want those things to go forward into the novel so that the reader is in some way troubled by the reality level of it. And so I wanted it to be as haunted a book as it could be in every possible way, because that was the way I could make it best, I think. But I hadn't thought of that as an explicit thing. But I should say at the end, everyone's bummed out, and I'm touching wood, but my girlfriend is pregnant at the moment, and it's all, please pray for us, going okay.
If I can just close with one last question. It struck me you mentioned cinema a few times, and film and bollocks like that. Oh, really? Because I had M. Night Shyamalan in my head.
Right.
Hitchcock, Revulsion, old films, and then what Shyamalan does to that. Is there any kind of influence consciously coming in from cinema?
Well, I've seen I don't know, his first two or films. I think that the influence of cinema on everyone is unavoidable,
yeah.
And it's profound. And profound in the sense that it is to do with how people relate to themselves, how they put themselves together, and how they express themselves to themselves, what physical actions they feel they can perform, and the ones that they aspire to performing, like being cool. Mm. If you're Sean Connery and you walk onto the set and you're pretending to be James Bond, you throw your hat towards the hat rack so you can impress Miss Moneypenny. You can have 50 takes and it doesn't go right, and then finally you get it and everyone can break for lunch.
Yeah.
If you're James Bond, you walk in and it happens, and that is a big difference. And I think people, even though they know that, they live their lives by the standards of cool and directness that cinema presents them with. So as a writer, I have to deal with the fact that the people I'm writing about are put together out of this other medium, that they are film-haunted subjects and television-haunted subjects, which is probably more what was going on in Finding Myself. Mm-hmm. So in a basic way, I can't pretend that these are sort of, this is virgin territory, the people's actions. But also, I don't want to write about these actions in a way that would be just familiar from cinema. where the language of an action, sort of lighting a cigarette, trembling and like this, so you know someone's had a shock or whatever, is essentially a cliche, but it's something someone would do because, you know, you find your husband's having an affair, so you do a Sue Ellen, you know, you hit the whiskey or whatever. So it all starts becoming a feedback loop where I'm influenced by cinema and the people I'm trying to write about are influenced by cinema, but I'm trying to break it at some point. And then after all of that, I write a scene in Ghost Story where Agatha is very distressed, and then Paddy and her have sex and she starts feeling fine. She starts making breakfast and she starts cooking things, and she's doing too many things at once, and she's poaching eggs and she's spilling them on the floor, and blah, it all goes terribly wrong and she ends up in a heap on the floor sobbing. And I realised, I watched Kramer versus Kramer, and I realised there's a scene in that where a very similar thing happens, but it's between a father and a son. It's because Mrs. Kramer has left, and Dustin is left holding the baby. So in a sense, there was a film scene that had come straight through, mm-hmm. had snuck mm-hmm. under my radar. Yeah. So that's at the level that that it operates, that it tells you how you think the world is, but it's not, and I'm trying to work against it in some way.
Stepping backwards to move forwards, in a way.
I think you need to in terms of reading writing that was pre-cinema is very interesting for the things it doesn't do and the things it does, and it's really right. the only way you can learn maybe some of the things that it does better. So I would say Henry James is an example of a writer who looks forward to cinema in some books by just writing dialogue and action in The Awkward Age, and then he says no, there's more, and tries to go beyond that. And so people have filmed his books, but I think that there is a real attempt to see the world subjectively from deep inside people, and books are about going inside other people, and I think films are about seeing the outside of other people.
Okay. All right, we'll stop there. If there are any other questions, do catch us afterwards, but just remains me to say that the bookshop is outside selling copies of Toby's books. There's a 10% discount and a 3-for-2 offer, and Toby will be here afterwards to sign books, come and have a chat. And next week's event on Wednesday night is Faye Weldon, so do come along.
Thank you.
Please join me in welcoming Toby Litt.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.